Arcas. Plato argues that evil is not a principle of strength, but of discord and dissolution. Just touching the question which has been often treated in modern times by theologians and philosophers of the negative nature of evil. In the last argument, we trace the germ of the Aristotelian doctrine of an end and a virtue directed towards the end, which again is suggested by the arts. The final reconcilement of justice and happiness and the identity of the individual and the state are also intimated. Socrates reassumes the character of a know-nothing. At the same time, he appears to be not wholly satisfied with the manner in which the argument has been conducted. Nothing is concluded, but the tendency of the dialectical process, here as always, is to enlarge our conception of ideas and to widen their application to human life. Book 2. Thrasymachus is pacified, but the intrepid Glaucon insists on continuing the argument. He is not satisfied with the indirect manner in which, at the end of the last book, Socrates had disposed of the question, whether the just or the unjust is the happier. He begins by dividing goods into three classes. First, goods desirable in themselves. Secondly, goods desirable in themselves and for their results. Thirdly, goods desirable for their results only. He then asks Socrates in which of the three classes he would place justice. In the second class, replies Socrates, among goods desirable for themselves and also for their results. Then the world in general are of another mind, for they say that justice belongs to the troublesome class of goods which are desirable for their results only. Socrates answers that this is the doctrine of Thrasymachus which he rejects. Glaucon thinks that Thrasymachus was too ready to listen to the voice of the charmer and proposes to consider the nature of justice and injustice in themselves and apart from the results and rewards of them, which the world is always dinning in his ears. He will first of all speak of the nature and origin of justice, secondly of the manner in which men view justice as a necessity and not a good, and thirdly, he will prove the reasonableness of this view. To do injustice is said to be a good, to suffer injustice an evil. As the evil is discovered by experience to be greater than the good, the sufferers, who cannot also be doers, make a compact that they will have neither, and this compact or mean is called justice, but is really the impossibility of doing injustice. No one would observe such a compact if he were not obliged. Let us suppose that the just and unjust have two rings, like that of Gyges in the well-known story, which make them invisible, and then no difference will appear in them, for every one will do evil if he can, and he who abstains will be regarded by the world as a fool for his pains. Men may praise him in public out of fear for themselves, but they will laugh at him in their hearts. Compare Gorgias. And now let us frame an ideal of the just and unjust. Imagine the unjust man to be master of his craft, seldom making mistakes and easily correcting them, having gifts of money, speech, strength, the greatest villain bearing the highest character. And at his side, let us place the just in his nobleness and simplicity, being, not seeming, without name or reward, clothed in his justice only, the best of men who has thought to be the worst, and let him die as he has lived. I might add, but I would rather put the rest into the mouth of the panegyrists of injustice, they will tell you, that the just man will be scourged, racked, bound, will have his eyes put out, and will at last be crucified, literally impaled. And all this because he ought to have preferred seeming to being. How different is the case of the unjust who clings to appearance as the true reality. His high character makes him a ruler. He can marry where he likes, trade where he likes, help his friends and hurt his enemies. Having got rich by dishonesty, he can worship the gods better, and will therefore be more loved by them than the just. I was thinking what to answer when Adamantus joined in the already unequal fray. He considered that the most important point of all had been omitted. Men are taught to be just for the sake of rewards. Parents and guardians make reputation the incentive to virtue, and other advantages are promised by them of a more solid kind, such as wealthy marriages and high offices. There are pictures in Homer and Hesiod of fat sheep and heavy fleeces, rich cornfields and trees toppling with fruit, which the gods provide in this life for the just. And the Orphic poets add a similar picture of another. The heroes of Musaeus and Eumolpus lie on couches at a festival with garlands on their heads, enjoying as the mead of virtue a paradise of immortal drunkenness. Some go further and speak of a fair posterity in the third and fourth generation. But the wicked they bury in a slough and make them carry water in a sieve. And in this life they attribute to them the infamy which Glaucon was assuming to be the lot of the just who are supposed to be unjust. Take another kind of argument which is found both in poetry and prose. Virtue, as Hesiod says, is honorable but difficult. Vice is easy and profitable. You may often see the wicked in great prosperity and the righteous afflicted by the will of heaven. And mendicant prophets knock at rich men's doors, promising to atone for the sins of themselves or their fathers in an easy fashion with sacrifices and festive games, or with charms and invocations to get rid of an enemy, good or bad, by divine help and at a small charge. They appeal to books professing to be written by Musaeus and Orpheus, and carry away the minds of whole cities, and promise to get souls out of purgatory, and if we refuse to listen to them, who knows what will happen to us? When a lively-minded, ingenuous youth hears all this, what will be his conclusion? Will he, in the language of Pindar, make justice his high tower, or fortify himself with crooked deceit? Justice, he reflects, without the appearance of justice, is misery and ruin. Injustice has the promise of a glorious life. Appearance is master of truth and lord of happiness. To appearance, then, I will turn. I will put on the show of virtue and trail behind me the fox of Archilochus. I hear someone saying that wickedness is not easily concealed, to which I reply that nothing great is easy. Union and force and rhetoric will do much, and if men say that they cannot prevail over the gods, still how do we know that there are gods? Only from the poets, who acknowledge that they may be appeased by sacrifices. Then why not sin and pay for indulgences out of your sin? For if the righteous are only unpunished, still they have no further reward, while the wicked may be unpunished and have the pleasure of sinning too. But what of the world below? Nay, says the argument, there are atoning powers who will set that matter right, as the poets, who are the sons of the gods, tell us, and this is confirmed by the authority of the state. How can we resist such arguments in favor of injustice? Add good manners, and as the wise tell us, we shall make the best of both worlds. Who that is not a miserable caitiff will refrain from smiling at the praises of justice? Even if a man knows the better part, he will not be angry with others, for he knows also that more than human virtue is needed to save a man, and that he only praises justice who is incapable of injustice. The origin of the evil is that all men from the beginning, heroes, poets, instructors of youth, have always asserted the temporal dispensation, the honors and profits of justice. Had we been taught in early youth the power of justice and injustice inherent in the soul, and unseen by any human or divine eye, we should not have needed others to be our guardians, but everyone would have been the guardian of himself. This is what I want you to show, Socrates. Other men use arguments which rather tend to strengthen the position of Thrasymachus, that might is right. But from you, I expect better things. And please, as Glaucon said, to exclude reputation. Let the just be thought unjust and the unjust just. And do you still prove to us the superiority of justice? The thesis, which for the sake of argument has been maintained by Glaucon, is the converse of that of Thrasymachus. Not right is the interest of the stronger, but right is the necessity of the weaker. Starting from the same premises, he carries the analysis of society a step further back. Might is still right, but the might is the weakness of the many combined against the strength of the few. There have been theories in modern as well as in ancient times which have a family likeness to the speculations of Glaucon. For example, that power is the foundation of right, or that a monarch has a divine right to govern well or ill, or that virtue is self-love or the love of power, or that war is the natural state of man, or that private vices are public benefits. All such theories have a kind of plausibility from their partial agreement with experience, for human nature oscillates between good and evil, and the motives of actions and the origin of institutions may be explained to a certain extent on either hypothesis according to the character or point of view of a particular thinker. The obligation of maintaining authority under all circumstances, and sometimes by rather questionable means, is felt strongly, and has become a sort of instinct among civilized men. The divine right of kings, or more generally of governments, is one of the forms under which this natural feeling is expressed. Nor again is there any evil which has not some accompaniment of good or pleasure, nor any good which is free from some alloy of evil, nor any noble or generous thought which may not be attended by a shadow or the ghost of a shadow of self-interest or of self-love. We know that all human actions are imperfect, but we do not therefore attribute them to the worse rather than to the better motive or principle. Such a philosophy is both foolish and false, like that opinion of the clever rogue who assumes all other men to be like himself. And theories of this sort do not represent the real nature of the state, which is based on a vague sense of right gradually corrected and enlarged by custom and law, although capable also of perversion, any more than they describe the origin of society, which is to be sought in the family and in the social and religious feelings of man. Nor do they represent the average character of individuals, which cannot be explained simply on a theory of evil, but has always a counteracting element of good. And as men become better, such theories appear more and more untruthful to them, because they are more conscious of their own disinterestedness. A little experience may make a man a cynic. A great deal will bring him back to a truer and kindlier view of the mixed nature of himself and his fellow men. The two brothers ask Socrates to prove to them that the just is happy when they have taken from him all that in which happiness is ordinarily supposed to consist. Not that there is, one, any absurdity in the attempt to frame a notion of justice apart from circumstances, for the ideal must always be a paradox when compared with the ordinary conditions of human life. Neither the Stoical ideal nor the Christian ideal is true as a fact, but they may serve as a basis of education, and may exercise an ennobling influence. An ideal is none the worse because someone has made the discovery that no such ideal was ever realized. And in a few exceptional individuals who are raised above the ordinary level of humanity, the ideal of happiness may be realized in death and misery. This may be the state which the reason deliberately approves, and which the utilitarian as well as every other moralist may be bound, in certain cases, to prefer. Nor again, too, must we forget that Plato, though he agrees generally with the view implied in the argument of the two brothers, is not expressing his own final conclusion, but rather seeking to dramatize one of the aspects of ethical truth. He is developing his idea gradually in a series of positions and situations. He is exhibiting Socrates for the first time undergoing the Socratic interrogation. Lastly, 3, the word happiness involves some degree of confusion because associated in the language of modern philosophy with conscious pleasure or satisfaction, which was not equally present to his mind. Glaucon has been drawing a picture of the misery of the just and the happiness of the unjust, to which the misery of the tyrant in Book 9 is the answer and parallel. And still the unjust must appear just, that is, the homage which vice pays to virtue. But now Adamantus, taking up the hint which had been already given by Glaucon, proceeds to show that in the opinion of mankind, justice is regarded only for the sake of rewards and reputation, and points out the advantage which is given to such arguments as those of Thrasymachus and Glaucon by the conventional morality of mankind. He seems to feel the difficulty of justifying the ways of God to man. Both the brothers touch upon the question whether the morality of actions is determined by their consequences, and both of them go beyond the position of Socrates, That justice belongs to the class of goods, not desirable for themselves only, but desirable for themselves and for their results, to which he recalls them. In their attempt to view justice as an internal principle, and in their condemnation of the poets, they anticipate him. The common life of Greece is not enough for them. They must penetrate deeper into the nature of things. It has been objected that justice is honesty in the sense of Glaucon and Adamantus, but is taken by Socrates to mean all virtue. May we not more truly say that the old-fashioned notion of justice is enlarged by Socrates and becomes equivalent to universal order or well-being, first in the state and secondly in the individual? He has found a new answer to his old question, Protagoras, whether the virtues are one or many, viz., that one is the ordering principle of the three others. In seeking to establish the purely internal nature of justice, he is met by the fact that man is a social being, and he tries to harmonize the two opposite theses as well as he can. There is no more inconsistency in this than was inevitable in his age and country. There is no use in turning upon him the crosslights of modern philosophy, which, from some other point of view, would appear equally inconsistent. Plato does not give the final solution of philosophical questions for us, nor can he be judged of by our standard. The remainder of the Republic is developed out of the question of the sons of Ariston. Three points are deserving of remark in what immediately follows. First, that the answer of Socrates is altogether indirect. He does not say that happiness consists in the contemplation of the idea of justice, and still less will he be tempted to affirm the Stoical paradox that the just man can be happy on the rack. But first he dwells on the difficulty of the problem and insists on restoring man to his natural condition before he will answer the question at all. He too will frame an ideal, but his ideal comprehends not only abstract justice, but the whole relations of man. Under the fanciful illustration of the large letters, he implies that he will only look for justice in society, and that from the state he will proceed to the individual. His answer in substance amounts to this, that under favorable conditions, that is, in the perfect state, justice and happiness will coincide, and that when justice has been once found, happiness may be left to take care of itself. That he falls into some degree of inconsistency when in the 10th book he claims to have got rid of the rewards and honors of justice may be admitted, for he has left those which exist in the perfect state. And the philosopher, who retires under the shelter of a wall, can hardly have been esteemed happy by him, at least not in this world. Still he maintains the true attitude of moral action. Let a man do his duty first, without asking whether he will be happy or not, and happiness will be the inseparable accident which attends him. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Secondly, it may be remarked that Plato preserves the genuine character of Greek thought in beginning with the state and in going on to the individual. First ethics, then politics. This is the order of ideas to us. The reverse is the order of history. Only after many struggles of thought does the individual assert his right as a moral being. In early ages he is not one, but one of many, the citizen of a state which is prior to him, and he has no notion of good or evil apart from the law of his country or the creed of his church. And to this type he is constantly tending to revert, whenever the influence of custom, or of party spirit, or the recollection of the past becomes too strong for him. Thirdly, we may observe the confusion or identification of the individual and the state, of ethics and politics, which pervades early Greek speculation, and even in modern times retains a certain degree of influence. The subtle difference between the collective and individual action of mankind seems to have escaped early thinkers, and we too are sometimes in danger of forgetting the conditions of united human action whenever we either elevate politics into ethics or lower ethics to the standard of politics. The good man and the good citizen only coincide in the perfect state, and this perfection cannot be attained by legislation acting upon them from without, but if at all, by education fashioning them from within. Socrates praises the sons of Ariston, inspired offspring of the renowned hero, as the elegiac poet terms them, but he does not understand how they can argue so eloquently on behalf of injustice, while their character shows that they are uninfluenced by their own arguments. He knows not how to answer them, although he is afraid of deserting justice in the hour of need. He therefore makes a condition, that having weak eyes, he shall be allowed to read the large letters first, and then go on to the smaller. That is, he must look for justice in the state first, and will then proceed to the individual. Accordingly, he begins to construct the state. Society arises out of the wants of man. His first want is food, his second a house, his third a coat. The sense of these needs, and the possibility of satisfying them by exchange, draw individuals together on the same spot, and this is the beginning of a state, which we take the liberty to invent, though necessity is the real inventor. There must be first a husbandman, secondly a builder, thirdly a weaver, to which may be added a cobbler. Four or five citizens at least are required to make a city. Now men have different natures, and one man will do one thing better than many, and business waits for no man. Hence there must be a division of labor into different employments, into wholesale and retail trade, into workers and makers of workmen's tools, into shepherds and husbandmen. A city which includes all this will have far exceeded the limit of four or five, and yet not be very large. But then again, imports will be required, and imports necessitate exports, and this implies variety of produce in order to attract the taste of purchasers, also merchants and ships. In the city, too, we must have a market, and money and retail trades. Otherwise, buyers and sellers will never meet, and the valuable time of the producers will be wasted in vain efforts at exchange. If we add hired servants, the state will be complete. And we may guess that somewhere in the intercourse of the citizens with one another, justice and injustice will appear. Here follows a rustic picture of their way of life. They spend their days in houses which they have built for themselves. They make their own clothes and produce their own corn and wine. Their principal food is meal and flour, and they drink in moderation. They live on the best of terms with each other, and take care not to have too many children. But, said Glaucon, interposing, are they not to have a relish? Certainly. They will have salt, and olives, and cheese, vegetables, and fruits, and chestnuts to roast at the fire. 'Tis a city of pigs, Socrates. Why, I replied, what do you want more? Only the comforts of life, sofas and tables, also sauces and sweets. I see. You want not only a state, but a luxurious state, and possibly in the more complex frame we may sooner find justice and injustice. Then the fine arts must go to work. Every conceivable instrument and ornament of luxury will be wanted. There will be dancers, painters, sculptors, musicians, cooks, barbers, tire women, nurses, artists, swineherds and neatherds too, for the animals, and physicians to cure the disorders of which luxury is the source. To feed all these superfluous mouths, we shall need a part of our neighbor's land, and they will want a part of ours. And this is the origin of war, which may be traced to the same causes as other political evils. Our city will now require the slight addition of a camp, and the citizen will be converted into a soldier. But then again our old doctrine of the division of labor must not be forgotten. The art of war cannot be learned in a day, and there must be a natural aptitude for military duties. There will be some warlike natures who have this aptitude, dogs keen of scent, swift of foot to pursue, and strong of limb to fight. And as spirit is the foundation of courage, such natures, whether of men or animals, will be full of spirit. But these spirited natures are apt to bite and devour one another. The union of gentleness to friends and fierceness against enemies appears to be an impossibility, and the guardian of a state requires both qualities. Who, then, can be a guardian? The image of the dog suggests an answer, for dogs are gentle to friends and fierce to strangers. Your dog is a philosopher who judges by the rule of knowing or not knowing. And philosophy, whether in man or beast, is the parent of gentleness. The human watchdogs must be philosophers or lovers of learning, which will make them gentle. And how are they to be learned without education? But what shall their education be? Is any better than the old-fashioned sort which is comprehended under the name of music and gymnastic? Music includes literature, and literature is of two kinds, true and false. What do you mean? He said. I mean that children hear stories before they learn gymnastics, and that the stories are either untrue, or have at most one or two grains of truth and a bushel of falsehood. Now early life is very impressible, and children ought not to learn what they will have to unlearn when they grow up. We must therefore have a censorship of nursery tales, banishing some and keeping others. Some of them are very improper, as we may see in the great instances of Homer and Hesiod, who not only tell lies, but bad lies. Stories about Uranus and Saturn, which are immoral as well as false, and which should never be spoken of to young persons, or indeed at all. Or, if at all, then in a mystery after the sacrifice, not of an Eleusinian pig, but of some unprocurable animal. Shall our youth be encouraged to beat their fathers by the example of Zeus, or our citizens be incited to quarrel by hearing or seeing representations of strife among the gods? Shall they listen to the narrative of Hephaestus binding his mother, and of Zeus sending him flying for helping her when she was beaten? Such tales may possibly have a mystical interpretation, but the young are incapable of understanding allegory. If anyone asks what tales are to be allowed, we will answer that we are legislators and not bookmakers. We only lay down the principles according to which books are to be written. To write them is the duty of others. And our first principle is that God must be represented as he is, not as the author of all things, but of good only. We will not suffer the poets to say that he is the steward of good and evil, or that he has two casks full of destinies, or that Athena and Zeus incited Pandarus to break the treaty, or that God caused the sufferings of Niobe, or of Pelops, or the Trojan War, or that he makes men sin when he wishes to destroy them. Either these were not the actions of the gods, or God was just and men were the better for being punished. But that the deed was evil and God the author is a wicked, suicidal fiction which we will allow no one, old or young, to utter. This is our first and great principle. God is the author of good only. And the second principle is like unto it. With God is no variableness or change of form. Reason teaches us this. For if we suppose a change in God, he must be changed either by another or by himself. By another? But the best works of nature and art, and the noblest qualities of mind, are least liable to be changed by any external force. By himself? But he cannot change for the better. He will hardly change for the worse. He remains forever fairest and best in his own image. Therefore, we refuse to listen to the poets who tell us of Hera begging in the likeness of a priestess, or of other deities who prowl about at night in strange disguises. All that blasphemous nonsense with which mothers fool the manhood out of their children must be suppressed. But some will say that God, who is himself unchangeable, may take a form in relation to us. Why should he? For gods as well as men hate the lie in the soul, or principle of falsehood. And as for any other form of lying which is used for a purpose and is regarded as innocent in certain exceptional cases, what need have the gods of this? For they are not ignorant of antiquity, like the poets, nor are they afraid of their enemies, nor is any madman a friend of theirs. God, then, is true. He is absolutely true. He changes not, he deceives not, by day or night, by word or sign. This is our second great principle. God is true. Away with the lying dream of Agamemnon and Homer, and the accusation of Thetis against Apollo in Aeschylus. In order to give clearness to his conception of the state, Plato proceeds to trace the first principles of mutual need and of division of labor in an imaginary community of four or five citizens. Gradually, this community increases. The division of labor extends to countries. Imports necessitate exports. A medium of exchange is required. And retailers sit in the marketplace to save the time of the producers. These are the steps by which Plato constructs the first or primitive state, introducing the elements of political economy by the way. As he is going to frame a second or civilized state, the simple naturally comes before the complex. He indulges, like Rousseau, in a picture of primitive life, an idea which has indeed often had a powerful influence on the imagination of mankind. But he does not seriously mean to say that one is better than the other, politicus. Nor can any inference be drawn from the description of the first state taken apart from the second, such as Aristotle appears to draw in the Politics. We should not interpret a Platonic dialogue any more than a poem or a parable into literal or a matter-of-fact style. On the other hand, when we compare the lively fancy of Plato with the dried-up abstractions of modern treatises on philosophy, we are compelled to say with Protagoras that the mythos is more interesting. Protagoras. Several interesting remarks which in modern times would have a place in a treatise on political economy are scattered up and down the writings of Plato, especially laws, population, free trade, adulteration, wills and bequests, begging, eryxias, though not Plato's, value and demand, republic, division of labor. The last subject, and also the origin of retail trade, is treated with admirable lucidity in the second book of the Republic. But Plato never combined his economic ideas into a system, and never seems to have recognized that trade is one of the great motive powers of the state and of the world. He would make retail traders only of the inferior sort of citizens, republic, laws. Though he remarks, quaintly enough, laws, that if only the best men and the best women everywhere were compelled to keep taverns for a time or to carry on retail trade, etc., then we should know how pleasant and agreeable all these things are. The disappointment of Glaucon at the City of Pigs, the ludicrous description of the ministers of luxury in the more refined state, and the afterthought of the necessity of doctors, the illustration of the nature of the guardian taken from the dog, the desirableness of offering some almost unprocurable victim when impure mysteries are to be celebrated, the behavior of Zeus to his father and of Hephaestus to his mother, are touches of humor which have also a serious meaning. In speaking of education, Plato rather startles us by affirming that a child must be trained in falsehood first and in truth afterwards. Yet this is not very different from saying that children must be taught through the medium of imagination as well as reason, that their minds can only develop gradually, and that there is much which they must learn without understanding. This is also the substance of Plato's view, though he must be acknowledged to have drawn the line somewhat differently from modern ethical writers, respecting truth and falsehood. To us, economies or accommodations would not be allowable unless they were required by the human faculties or necessary for the communication of knowledge to the simple and ignorant. We should insist that the word was inseparable from the intention, and that we must not be falsely true, that is, speak or act falsely in support of what was right or true. But Plato would limit the use of fictions only by requiring that they should have a good moral effect, and that such a dangerous weapon as falsehood should be employed by the rulers alone and for great objects. A Greek, in the age of Plato, attached no importance to the question whether his religion was a historical fact. He was just beginning to be conscious that the past had a history, but he could see nothing beyond Homer and Hesiod. Whether their narratives were true or false did not seriously affect the political or social life of Hellas. Men only began to suspect that they were fictions when they recognized them to be immoral. And so in all religions, the consideration of their morality comes first, afterwards the truth of the documents in which they are recorded, or of the events, natural or supernatural, which are told of them. But in modern times, and in Protestant countries perhaps more than in Catholic, we have been too much inclined to identify the historical with the moral. And some have refused to believe in religion at all, unless a superhuman accuracy was discernible in every part of the record. The facts of an ancient or religious history are amongst the most important of all facts, but they are frequently uncertain, and we only learn the true lesson which is to be gathered from them when we place ourselves above them. These reflections tend to show that the difference between Plato and ourselves, though not unimportant, is not so great as might at first sight appear, for we should agree with him in placing the moral before the historical truth of religion, and, generally, in disregarding those errors or misstatements of fact which necessarily occur in the early stages of all religions. We know also that changes in the traditions of a country cannot be made in a day, and are therefore tolerant of many things which science and criticism would condemn. We note in passing that the allegorical interpretation of mythology, said to have been first introduced as early as the 6th century before Christ by Theagenes of Rhegium, was well established in the age of Plato, and here, as in the Phaedrus, though for a different reason, was rejected by him. That anachronisms, whether of religion or law, when men have reached another stage of civilization, should be got rid of by fictions is in accordance with universal experience. Great is the art of interpretation, and by a natural process, which when once discovered was always going on, what could not be altered was explained away. And so, without any palpable inconsistency, there existed side by side two forms of religion, the tradition inherited or invented by the poets and the customary worship of the temple. On the other hand, there was the religion of the philosopher, who was dwelling in the heaven of ideas, but did not therefore refuse to offer a cock to Aesculapius, or to be seen saying his prayers at the rising of the sun. At length, the antagonism between the popular and philosophical religion, never so great among the Greeks as in our own age, disappeared, and was only felt like the difference between the religion of the educated and uneducated among ourselves. The Zeus of Homer and Hesiod easily passed into the royal mind of Plato, Philebus. The giant Heracles became the knight-errant and benefactor of mankind. These, and still more wonderful transformations, were readily effected by the ingenuity of Stoics and Neoplatonists in the 2 or 3 centuries before and after Christ. The Greek and Roman religions were gradually permeated by the spirit of philosophy. Having lost their ancient meaning, they were resolved into poetry and morality, and probably were never purer than at the time of their decay, when their influence over the world was waning. A singular conception which occurs towards the end of the book is the lie in the soul. This is connected with the Platonic and Socratic doctrine that involuntary ignorance is worse than voluntary. The lie in the soul is a true lie, the corruption of the highest truth, the deception of the highest part of the soul, from which he who is deceived has no power of delivering himself. For example, to represent God as false or immoral, or, according to Plato, as deluding men with appearances or as the author of evil. Or again, to affirm with Protagoras that knowledge is sensation, or that being is becoming, or with Thrasymachus that might is right, would have been regarded by Plato as a lie of this hateful sort. The greatest unconsciousness of the greatest untruth, for example, if, in the language of the Gospels, John, he who was blind were to say, I see, is another aspect of the state of mind which Plato is describing. The lie in the soul may be further compared with the sin against the Holy Ghost, Luke, allowing for the difference between Greek and Christian modes of speaking. To this is opposed the lie in words, which is only such a deception as may occur in a play or poem, or allegory or figure of speech, or in any sort of accommodation, which, though useless to the gods, may be useful to men in certain cases. Socrates is here answering the question which he had himself raised about the propriety of deceiving a madman, and he is also contrasting the nature of God and man. For God is truth, but mankind can only be true by appearing sometimes to be partial or false. Reserving for another place the greater questions of religion or education, we may note further, 1, the approval of the old traditional education of Greece, 2, the preparation which Plato is making for the attack on Homer and the poets, 3, the preparation which he is also making for the use of economies in the state, 4, the contemptuous and at the same time euphemistic manner in which here as below he alludes to the Chronique Scandaleuse of the Gods. Book 3. There is another motive in purifying religion, which is to banish fear. For no man can be courageous who is afraid of death, or who believes the tales which are repeated by the poets concerning the world below. They must be gently requested not to abuse hell. They may be reminded that their stories are both untrue and discouraging. Nor must they be angry if we expunge obnoxious passages, such as the depressing words of Achilles, "I would rather be a serving man than rule over all the dead," and the verses which tell of the squalid mansions, the senseless shadows, the flitting soul mourning over lost strength and youth, the soul with a gibber going beneath the earth like smoke, or the souls of the suitors which flutter about like bats, the terrors and horrors of Cocytus and Styx, ghosts and sapless shades, and the rest of their Tartarian nomenclature, must vanish. Such tales may have their use, but they are not the proper food for soldiers. As little can we admit the sorrows and sympathies of the Homeric heroes, Achilles, the son of Thetis, in tears throwing ashes on his head, or pacing up and down the seashore in distraction, or Priam, the cousin of the gods, crying aloud, rolling in the mire. A good man is not prostrated at the loss of children or fortune. Neither is death terrible to him, and therefore lamentations over the dead should not be practiced by men of note. They should be the concern of inferior persons only, whether women or men. Still worse is the attribution of such weakness to the gods, as when the goddesses say, "Alas, my travail," and worst of all, when the king of heaven himself laments his inability to save Hector, or sorrows over the impending doom of his dear Sarpedon. Such a character of God, if not ridiculed by our young men, is likely to be imitated by them. Nor should our citizens be given to excess of laughter. Such violent delights are followed by a violent reaction. The description in the Iliad of the gods shaking their sides at the clumsiness of Hephaestus will not be admitted by us. Certainly not. Truth should have a high place among the virtues, for falsehood, as we were saying, is useless to the gods, and only useful to men as a medicine. But this employment of falsehood must remain a privilege of state. The common man must not in return tell a lie to the ruler, any more than the patient would tell a lie to his physician, or the sailor to his captain. In the next place, our youth must be temperate, and temperance consists in self-control and obedience to authority. That is a lesson which Homer teaches in some places. The Achaeans marched on breathing prowess, in silent awe of their leaders, but a very different one in other places. O heavy with wine, who hast the eyes of a dog, but the heart of a stag. Language of the latter kind will not impress self-control on the minds of youth. The same may be said about his praises of eating and drinking, and his dread of starvation, also about the verses in which he tells of the rapturous loves of Zeus and Hera, or of how Hephaestus once detained Ares and Aphrodite in a net on a similar occasion. There is a nobler strain heard in the words, "Endure, my soul, thou hast endured worse." Nor must we allow our citizens to receive bribes, or to say, "Gifts persuade the gods, gifts reverend kings," or to applaud the ignoble advice of Phoenix to Achilles that he should get money out of the Greeks before he assisted them, or the meanness of Achilles himself in taking gifts from Agamemnon, or his requiring a ransom for the body of Hector, or his cursing of Apollo, or his insolence to the river god Scamander, or his dedication to the dead Patroclus of his own hair, which had been already dedicated to the other river god Spurcius, or his cruelty in dragging the body of Hector round the walls and slaying the captives at the pyre. Such a combination of meanness and cruelty in Chiron's pupil is inconceivable. The amatory exploits of Pirithous and Theseus are equally unworthy. Either these so-called sons of gods were not the sons of gods, or they were not such as the poets imagined them, any more than the gods themselves are the authors of evil. The youth who believes that such things are done by those who have the blood of heaven flowing in their veins will be too ready to imitate their example. Enough of gods and heroes. What shall we say about men? What the poets and storytellers say? That the wicked prosper and the righteous are afflicted? or that justice is another's gain? Such misrepresentations cannot be allowed by us. But in this we are anticipating the definition of justice, and had therefore better defer the inquiry. The subjects of poetry have been sufficiently treated. Next follows style. Now, all poetry is a narrative of events past, present, or to come, and narrative is of three kinds, the simple, the imitative, and a composition of the two. An instance will make my meaning clear. The first scene in Homer is of the last or mixed kind, being partly description and partly dialogue. But if you throw the dialogue into the oratio obliqua, the passage will run thus. The priest came and prayed Apollo that the Achaeans might take Troy and have a safe return if Agamemnon would only give him back his daughter. And the other Greeks assented, but Agamemnon was wroth, and so on. The whole then becomes descriptive, and the poet is the only speaker left. Or, if you omit the narrative, the whole becomes dialogue. These are the three styles. Which of them is to be admitted into our state? Do you ask whether tragedy and comedy are to be admitted? Yes, but also something more. Is it not doubtful whether our guardians are to be imitators at all? Or rather, has not the question been already answered? For we have decided that one man cannot in his life play many parts, any more than he can act both tragedy and comedy, or be rhapsodist and actor at once. Human nature is coined into very small pieces, and as our guardians have their own business already, which is the care of freedom, they will have enough to do without imitating. If they imitate, they should imitate, not any meanness or baseness, but the good only, for the mask which the actor wears is apt to become his face. We cannot allow men to play the parts of women, quarreling, weeping, scolding, or boasting against the gods, least of all when making love or in labor. They must not represent slaves, or bullies, or cowards, drunkards, or madmen, or blacksmiths, or neighing horses, or bellowing bulls, or sounding rivers, or a raging sea. A good or wise man will be willing to perform good and wise actions, but he will be ashamed to play an inferior part which he has never practiced, and he will prefer to employ the descriptive style with as little imitation as possible. The man who has no self-respect, on the contrary, will imitate anybody and anything, sounds of nature and cries of animals alike. His whole performance will be imitation of gesture and voice. Now, in the descriptive style, there are few changes, but in the dramatic, there are a great many. Poets and musicians use either, or a compound of both. And this compound is very attractive to youth and their teachers as well as to the vulgar. But our state, in which one man plays one part only, is not adapted for complexity. And when one of these polyphonous pantomimic gentlemen offers to exhibit himself and his poetry, we will show him every observance of respect, but at the same time, tell him that there is no room for his kind in our state. We prefer the rough, honest poet, and will not depart from our original models, laws. Next, as to the music. A song or ode has three parts, the subject, the harmony, and the rhythm, of which the two last are dependent upon the first. As we banished strains of lamentation, so we may now banish the mixed Lydian harmonies, which are the harmonies of lamentation. And as our citizens are to be temperate, we may also banish convivial harmonies, such as the Ionian and pure Lydian. Two remain, the Dorian and Phrygian, the first for war, the second for peace, the one expressive of courage, the other of obedience or instruction or religious feeling. And as we reject varieties of harmony, we shall also reject the many-stringed, variously shaped instruments which give utterance to them, and in particular the flute, which is more complex than any of them. The lyre and the harp may be permitted in the town, and the pan's pipe in the fields. Thus we have made a purgation of music, and will now make a purgation of meters. These should be like the harmonies, simple and suitable to the occasion. There are four notes of the tetrachord, and there are three ratios of meter, 3-2, 2-2, 2-1, which have all their characteristics, and the feet have different characteristics as well as the rhythm. But about this you and I must ask Damon, the great musician, who speaks, if I remember rightly, of a martial measure as well as of dactylic, trochaic, and iambic rhythms, which he arranges so as to equalize the syllables with one another, assigning to each the proper quantity. We only venture to affirm the general principle that the style is to conform to the subject and the meter to the style, and that the simplicity and harmony of the soul should be reflected in them all. This principle of simplicity has to be learnt by everyone in the days of his youth, and may be gathered anywhere from the creative and constructive arts, as well as from the forms of plants and animals. Other artists, as well as poets, should be warned against meanness or unseemliness. Sculpture and painting equally with music must conform to the law of simplicity. He who violates it cannot be allowed to work in our city and to corrupt the taste of our citizens. For our guardians must grow up not amid images of deformity which will gradually poison and corrupt their souls, but in a land of health and beauty, where they will drink in from every object sweet and harmonious influences. And of all these influences, the greatest is the education given by music, which finds a way into the innermost soul and imparts to it the sense of beauty and of deformity. At first the effect is unconscious, but when reason arrives, then he who has been thus trained welcomes her as the friend whom he always knew. As in learning to read, first we acquire the elements or letters separately, and afterwards their combinations, and cannot recognize reflections of them until we know the letters themselves. In like manner, we must first attain the elements or essential forms of the virtues, and then trace their combinations in life and experience. There is a music of the soul which answers to the harmony of the world, and the fairest object of a musical soul is the fair mind in the fair body. Some defect in the latter may be excused, but not in the former. True love is the daughter of temperance, and temperance is utterly opposed to the madness of bodily pleasure. Enough has been said of music, which makes a fair ending with love. Next we pass on to gymnastics, about which I would remark that the soul is related to the body as a cause to an effect, and therefore if we educate the mind, we may leave the education of the body in her charge, and need only give a general outline of the course to be pursued. In the first place, the guardians must abstain from strong drink, for they should be the last persons to lose their wits. Whether the habits of the palestra are suitable to them is more doubtful, for the ordinary gymnastic is a sleepy sort of thing, and if left off suddenly is apt to endanger health. But our warrior athletes must be wide-awake dogs, and must also be inured to all changes of food and climate. Hence they will require a simpler kind of gymnastic, akin to their simple music. And for their diet, a rule may be found in Homer, who feeds his heroes on roast meat only, and gives them no fish although they are living at the seaside, nor boiled meats which involve an apparatus of pots and pans. And, if I am not mistaken, he nowhere mentions sweet sauces. Sicilian cookery and Attic confections and Corinthian courtesans, which are to gymnastic what Lydian and Ionian melodies are to music, must be forbidden. Where gluttony and intemperance prevail, the town quickly fills with doctors and pleaders, and law and medicine give themselves airs as soon as the freemen of a state take an interest in them. But what can show a more disgraceful state of education than to have to go abroad for justice because you have none of your own at home? And yet there is a worse stage of the same disease, when men have learned to take a pleasure and pride in the twists and turns of the law, not considering how much better it would be for them so to order their lives as to have no need of a nodding justice. And there is a like disgrace in employing a physician, not for the cure of wounds or epidemic disorders, but because a man has, by laziness and luxury, contracted diseases which were unknown in the days of Asclepius. How simple is the Homeric practice of medicine! Eurypylus, after he has been wounded, drinks a posset of Pramnian wine, which is of a heating nature. And yet the sons of Asclepius blame neither the damsel who gives him the drink, nor Patroclus who is attending on him. The truth is that this modern system of nursing diseases was introduced by Herodicus the trainer, who, being of a sickly constitution, by a compound of training and medicine, tortured first himself and then a good many other people, and lived a great deal longer than he had any right. But Asclepius would not practice this art, because he knew that the citizens of a well-ordered state had no leisure to be ill, and therefore he adopted the kill-or-cure method, which artisans and laborers employ. They must be at their business, they say, and have no time for coddling. If they recover, well. If they don't, there is an end of them. Whereas the rich man is supposed to be a gentleman who can afford to be ill. Do you know a maxim of Phocylides, that when a man begins to be rich, or perhaps a little sooner, he should practice virtue? But how can excessive care of health be inconsistent with an ordinary occupation, and yet consistent with that practice of virtue which Phocylides inculcates? When a student imagines that philosophy gives him a headache, he never does anything. He is always unwell. This was the reason why Asclepius and his sons practiced no such art. They were acting in the interest of the public, and did not wish to preserve useless lives or raise up a puny offspring to wretched sires. Honest diseases they honestly cured, and if a man was wounded, they applied the proper remedies, and then let him eat and drink what he liked. But they declined to treat intemperate and worthless subjects, even though they might have made large fortunes out of them. As to the story of Pindar, that Asclepius was slain by a thunderbolt for restoring a rich man to life, that is a lie. Following our old rule, we must say either he did or not take bribes, or that he was not the son of a god. Glaucon then asks Socrates whether the best physicians and the best judges will not be those who have had severally the greatest experience of diseases and of crimes. Socrates draws a distinction between the two professions. The physician should have had experience of disease in his own body, for he cures with his mind and not with his body. But the judge controls mind by mind, and therefore his mind should not be corrupted by crime. Where then is he to gain experience? How is he to be wise and also innocent? When young, a good man is apt to be deceived by evildoers, because he has no pattern of evil in himself, and therefore the judge should be of a certain age. His youth should have been innocent, and he should have acquired insight into evil not by the practice of it, but by the observation of it in others. This is the ideal of a judge. The criminal-turned-detective is wonderfully suspicious, but when in company with good men who have experience, he is at fault, for he foolishly imagines that everyone is as bad as himself. Vice may be known of virtue, but cannot know virtue. This is the sort of medicine, and this the sort of law which will prevail in our state. They will be healing arts to better natures, but the evil body will be left to die by the one, and the evil soul will be put to death by the other. And the need of either will be greatly diminished by good music, which will give harmony to the soul, and good gymnastic, which will give health to the body. Not that this division of music and gymnastic really corresponds to soul and body, for they are both equally concerned with the soul, which is tamed by the one and aroused and sustained by the other. The two together supply our guardians with their twofold nature. The passionate disposition, when it has too much gymnastic, is hardened and brutalized. The gentle or philosophic temper, which has too much music, becomes enervated. While a man is allowing music to pour like water through the funnel of his ears, the edge of his soul gradually wears away, and the passionate or spirited element is melted out of him. Too little spirit is easily exhausted. Too much quickly passes into nervous irritability. So, again, the athlete by feeding and training has his courage doubled, but he soon grows stupid. He is like a wild beast, ready to do everything by blows and nothing by counsel or policy. There are two principles in man, reason and passion, and to these, not to the soul and body, the two arts of music and gymnastic correspond. He who mingles them in harmonious concord is the true musician. He shall be the presiding genius of our state. The next question is, who are to be our rulers? First, the elder must rule the younger, and the best of the elders will be the best guardians. Now they will be the best who love their subjects most, and think that they have a common interest with them in the welfare of the state. These we must select, but they must be watched at every epoch of life to see whether they have retained the same opinions and held out against force and enchantment. For time and persuasion and the love of pleasure may enchant a man into a change of purpose, and the force of grief and pain may compel him. And therefore our guardians must be men who have been tried by many tests, like gold in the refiner's fire, and have been passed first through danger, then through pleasure, and at every age have come out of such trials victorious and without stain, in full command of themselves and their principles, having all their faculties in harmonious exercise for their country's good. These shall receive the highest honors both in life and death. It would perhaps be better to confine the term guardians to this select class. The younger men may be called auxiliaries. And now for one magnificent lie, in the belief of which, oh, that we could train our rulers. At any rate, let us make the attempt with the rest of the world. What I am going to tell is only another version of the legend of Cadmus, but our unbelieving generation will be slow to accept such a story. The tale must be imparted first to the rulers, then to the soldiers, lastly to the people. We will inform them that their youth was a dream, and that during the time when they seemed to be undergoing their education, they were really being fashioned in the earth, who sent them up when they were ready, and that they must protect and cherish her whose children they are, and regard each other as brothers and sisters. I do not wonder at your being ashamed to propound such a fiction. There is more behind. These brothers and sisters have different natures, and some of them God framed to rule, whom he fashioned of gold. Others he made of silver to be auxiliaries, others again to be husbandmen and craftsmen, and these were formed by him of brass and iron. But as they are all sprung from a common stock, a golden parent may have a silver son, or a silver parent a golden son. And then there must be a change of rank. The son of the rich must descend, and the child of the artisan rise, in the social scale. For an oracle says that the state will come to an end if governed by a man of brass or iron. Will our citizens ever believe all this? Not in the present generation, but in the next, perhaps, yes. Now let the earthborn men go forth under the command of their rulers, and look about and pitch their camp in a high place, which will be safe against enemies from without, and likewise against insurrections from within. There let them sacrifice and set up their tents. For soldiers they are to be, and not shopkeepers, the watchdogs and guardians of the sheep. And luxury and avarice will turn them into wolves and tyrants. Their habits and their dwellings should correspond to their education. They should have no property, their pay should only meet their expenses, and they should have common meals. Gold and silver we will tell them that they have from God. And this divine gift in their souls they must not alloy with that earthly dross which passes under the name of gold. They only of the citizens may not touch it, or be under the same roof with it, or drink from it. It is the accursed thing. Should they ever acquire houses or lands or money of their own, they will become householders and tradesmen instead of guardians, enemies and tyrants instead of helpers, and the hour of ruin, both to themselves and the rest of the state, will be at hand. The religious and ethical aspect of Plato's education will hereafter be considered under a separate head. Some lesser points may be more conveniently noticed in this place. 1. The constant appeal to the authority of Homer, whom, with grave irony, Plato, after the manner of his age, summons as a witness about ethics and psychology, as well as about diet and medicine, attempting to distinguish the better lesson from the worse, sometimes altering the text from design, more than once quoting or alluding to Homer inaccurately, after the manner of the early logographers, turning the Iliad into prose, and delighting to draw far-fetched inferences from his words, or to make ludicrous applications of them. He does not, like Heraclitus, get into a rage with Homer and Archilochus, Heraclitus, but uses their words and expressions as vehicles of a higher truth, not on a system like Theagenes of Rhegium or Metrodorus, or in later times the Stoics, but as fancy may dictate. And the conclusions drawn from them are sound, although the